Broadcasting live from the Civic Media Studios in Green Bay, this is Nightlight with Pete Chwaba, your inside source on everything entertainment from Wisconsin to Hollywood. And now, a guy who once tore his ACL playing chess, Pete Chwaba.
Welcome back. We are kicking off hour number two here, broadcasting statewide from our beautiful studios here in downtown Green Bay. We are talking, we've got a lot of great subjects tonight. We had comedy and music last night. Tonight, we have podcast host of the Mob and Mafia News. Bob Dennis is here. Author Linda Drews will be here at 8:35. So a lot of mystery, a lot of crime. This is really fun stuff to talk about. Let's start with Tony Accardo, because mm-hmm. I find him fascinating. I you know, you always hear about these mob guys that have a code, which fascinates me too, because to get where they have to get, they have to be ruthless.
Mm-hmm.
And you're absolutely like, how could a guy like that have a code? But a code doesn't necessarily mean you're a great guy. But he is rumored to never have spent a night in jail.
Mm-hmm. No, never.
Never. And he ran the Chicago mob for parts of 8 decades or something like that, mm-hmm. or 7 decades. And I told you off the air, I read Bill Romer's books, who is a former FBI agent, and he talks in his books about getting the go-ahead from Hoover to bug the mob. That's how it all started, and that's how they started building their cases. Apparently, the mob threatened the FBI. This is according to Romer in one of his books. He went to Tony Accardo's house and said, listen, you threatened our family. You have families, too. You don't want to piss us off. Can we agree not to keep the families out of it? And Accardo said, okay, and they did.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, I mean, is that true. Your yes. knowledge as
anybody,
well?
Anybody who was not directly involved in the controversy between the two, or the professional aspects, professional one-on-one, whether you were law enforcement or mafia, that was one thing. Family was never brought into it, ever.
Right.
And when that happened, that was true. They met and they worked out and negotiated and said, look, this isn't right. This isn't going to happen.
So Accardo's nickname was Joe Batters. Mm-hmm. He had other nicknames too. Supposedly he started in Little Italy. He and his buddy, I think Sam Giancana, was in the same group.
Mm-hmm.
And they started, you know, they were like Henry Hill, I guess, when he was a kid in Goodfellas, running errands for the mob. He works his way up. Maybe he was one of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre shooters. And he ends up running the mob. Official boss, not that long, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong. But then he stepped back and put Sam Giancana in charge, and he kind of stayed back. I mean, very brilliant. He didn't need the spotlight like Giancana did. He was like quiet and soft-spoken. So what are your thoughts overall on Tony Accardo?
Pretty amazing, actually, overall.
And there's been no movie made about him.
Oh, no,
I think he is fascinating. Like, to me, he's more fascinating than any of the New York Godfathers, or, you know, Trafficante, or whoever, Mickey Cohen maybe, but I find Accardo fascinating.
After Capone was put away in 1932 for tax evasion, the then successor was Frank Nitti. Frank
right.
Nitti supposedly committed suicide by shooting himself twice in the head. Yeah. Work that one out. And then after Frank Nitti became Paul the Waiter Rica, mm-hmm. who was in charge. But Paul the Waiter Rica really didn't. He ran things, but it was like, yeah, I'll tell you what. Come on over here, Tuna, and you do it. So he was the head guy, but it was really Tony Accardo that ran everything, basically from about 1946 until 1972 when he stepped down.
Okay.
I mean, he was the guy that ran everything day to day. I mean, it was him, but he didn't have the name for it, and he didn't want to have anybody know who he was, because he knew that when you were out in public and everybody saw your face, heard your name, and knew what was going on, your lifetime was limited.
Right.
So
Big Tuna is his other mm-hmm. nickname that yep. I couldn't think of before. And he now, so walk me through this, Bob. How did the Chicago mob, and this is according to Bill Romer, mm-hmm. they controlled everything west of the Mississippi, Cleveland, Milwaukee. Is it because they owned, like, and there was a saying that said Hollywood couldn't make a movie without Chicago's okay. Mm-hmm. Is that because they controlled the unions?
Yes, to a big part. The one thing is, though, is that all of the mafias had a cut of everything in every other small city. So everybody had a little piece of Kansas City. Everybody had a little piece of Minneapolis. Everybody had a little piece of St. Louis. Everybody had a piece of what was going on out in California. There is actually a book by Gus Russo called Supermob, and it talks about specifically Hollywood and the movies and how it was controlled. It's a fairly thick volume, but you couldn't get any more in-depth than that book. And it indeed talks about the control of the movie industry by way of the unions, which was not unusual. A side note, I know totally it's only related because it's union. During World War II, America was having a hard time defending the coasts, the East and West coasts. So they went to the mafia and they said, listen, you guys are longshoremen. You know what's going on here. You've got the people. Why don't you guys help us out and we'll back off on you a little bit and keep the coast safe. So it was actually the unions and the longshoremen that helped to keep the coast safe during World War II. And again, that union tie-in was what made me think of it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I also remember from one of those books that, and this was what made me think, all right, maybe they were that powerful, because the Chicago mob, when Vegas, I think they had divided up Vegas with New York, but they knew ahead of time somehow that the government was going to shut down Vegas and they were coming in. So they said, you give us these hotels, grandfather these to us, we'll give you any new development. And New York said, okay, and only realized they had been hoodwinked like a year or two later. And I thought, wow, like how conniving. And like, it's all about the money though, right?
Yes,
I mean, there's
always
just so much money to be made.
Always. Well, and one of the people who was greatly respected, believe it or not, overall, because of his business abilities was Frank Balestrieri. He was the one who came up with the idea of shorting the casinos. At that time, they used to take these carts, and the carts were filled with money, okay, with coins. They would weigh them before they filled them with coins, okay, and it would have a certain weight to it, just like going to the salvage yard. And it would say, okay, this thing weighs 100 pounds. They would fill it with coins, and let's say when they were done with it, it might weigh 300 pounds. So they knew that 200 pounds was coins, and they knew how much of a value there was to $200 in coins, or 200 pounds in coins. But then what they would do is in the weight of the weigh room, they would switch carts so that so it wouldn't have the 200 pounds, it'd have 150. So they got 50 pounds for whatever number of hundreds of thousands of dollars that were there. And they ended up making millions and millions of dollars off of that.
That fascinated me, like how, I mean, they really did seem like it was about business and they could be ruthless about it. But so let's talk about Balestrieri. The Milwaukee mob, I didn't know much about the Milwaukee mob until I started doing stand-up comedy, interestingly enough, and I worked a club there. And
you're
one
very
of the,
brave.
One of the people that was associated with the club said, oh, I'll take you to meet Frank Balestrieri. He hangs out at, I think it was called Snugs at the Shorecrest Hotel. Okay. And I was very nervous. I'm like, I don't want to meet a mob guy. Like, well, he's going to kill me. And then it's like, you're a comedian. You know, you're not a threat. But we did go there that night, and he was not there. But what is he the one that took the rap for his sons? He did jail time, apparently, to keep his boys out of prison.
To
I thought I read
safe.
That.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. It. The amazing thing about Frank Balestrieri is that, yes, he was a member of the mafia, the mob, but he was also a businessman. He owned all kinds of property and businesses
legitimate
in the Milwaukee area.
Businesses.
Legitimate
yeah.
businesses.
Wow.
And the thing, and it's a consistent theme with people who are in the mafia, where they turn out to be excellent businessmen.
Yeah.
Most of them not very well educated. Capone actually only made it to sixth grade, but he had a knack for numbers. He had almost an uncanny ability to do the numbers in his head. So, and true for many of the different peoples who were members of the mafia, that included Frank. He had a better education, but he was also much smarter about not getting himself in trouble. He was another one who realized, you know, your lifetime is short if you don't pay attention. And I think if I recall, and I'm not going to swear to this as a date, but I believe that he took over right around 1960.
Okay.
And he remained in power for many, many, many years.
My guest is Bob Dennis. He hosts the Mob and Mafia News podcast. You could check it out. How can they find it again, Bob?
Well, it's you can do the go to TikTok and just look for Mob and Mafia News, and there is a link to the actual website there. That's the easiest way to get it. And again, once again, it's a cheap guy kind of thing, an old radio person. I didn't want to put a lot of money into something and you know, end up having it not work, but I was surprised because I just started the Mob and Mafia back in February. And so far, it's somewhere just over 65,000 listens.
Wow, nice and work. Wow.
The other podcast, which is Urban Legends and Stranger Truths, which is just about odd news that goes on in the world, that so far this year has about 650,000 listens. So
that's incredible. So what are your thoughts overall? Is Milwaukee a mob town?
Yes, but it is a lesser level town. It lives in the shadow of Chicago. They don't move unless something is first, for lack of a better word, vetted or cleared with Chicago.
Okay.
Chicago would not make a big deal out of it, but they don't want Milwaukee to be an upstart, to put it simply.
Okay.
But there was a lot of potential in Milwaukee. There's a lot of business in Milwaukee that is all interrelated. They in essence worked hand in glove, like a little brother.
Okay. Who, in your opinion, who are the most influential mafia members in America? I assume you go back pre-Accardo, even pre-Capone, or maybe not. Who, in your opinion?
Well, the really big ones were Capone, obviously, because he took control of everything. He made it all work. But you have to also go out to New York, and Lucky Luciano was the one who actually put together the commission.
Right.
He was, and the way he did it was there was something called the Castelmoresi War between two warring factions of the mafia. And the reason they were warring is because he had been a member of both of the different organizations, and he set them against each other so that he could come out as the kingmaker, and he made himself basically the godfather.
Wow. That's all right. So Lucky Luciano, who else you got on that list?
Accardo, because of his ability to just be sustained, to just live, he has surviving living descendants who are still in the Chicago area.
Oh, his legacy with the Bosa brothers in the NFL are, I think, his great grandsons.
Yep.
And then there was another guy who played for the Packers. Oh, I can't remember his name, but Eric Kumerow was his step grandson or something.
Yes.
I mean, yeah. Crazy that they have this legacy.
Yeah, it and of course they all kind of nudge that when they need it to, you know.
Yeah, right.
You know, I got somebody I want you to talk to.
All right, next on Nightlight, I'm gonna ask Bob who he thinks killed certain people.
Uh-oh.
I'm not saying he knows, but we'll talk a little bit of mob movie stuff before we let him get out of here. This is Pete Schwab and Nightlight on the Civic Media Radio Network.
I wanna cry, cry, cry alone. When you're feeling blue, I'm waiting just for you. Someone's living for their love. Someone's living for their love. And I love her.
Welcome back. We have a few more minutes here with Bob Dennist. He is the host of the Mob and Mafia News podcast. Check that out. Google it. Go to TikTok. You can find his episodes there. And tonight we are talking mafia. At 8:35, author Linda Drews will be here to talk about her mystery books and all the books she's written. She is also situated here in Green Bay. So I have two local call yourself a literary person, Bob, or more of a reporter? You said you were a reporter for years.
Well, for about 11 years.
Okay.
But that was many years ago.
Yeah.
I have a whole different career since then. But
who killed Sam Giancana in his basement in Oak Park, Illinois?
The truth?
Yeah.
You'll never know 100% the truth, but it will be other mafia members. He had gotten out of control.
Tony Accardo probably gave the okay?
Probably. It would not have happened without okay. I mean, right. It would never have happened. He was a made man. He was a well-known made man.
He was considered the boss of the Chicago mob when he was out in Hollywood and dating all these actresses. And
Yes. Judith Exner and her relationship with both Giancana and Kennedy.
Kennedy, right.
Yeah. And a lot of times you get these guys who get this feeling that they're not subject to all the rules that apply to everybody else. And Giancana was one of them.
Wow.
And kind of crazy.
So who killed Jimmy Hoffa? You think the mob had something to do with that?
Another guy who felt like, I mean, he came back. And if you remember, I don't know if you're old enough to remember, when he came back after having been in prison, he was like well, I'm going to reestablish everything. I'm going to remake everything. I'm going to be the king again. I'm going to take care of it. And I think that was a joint effort between the mob and the union. I think that nobody wanted him around because he was such a hot package to handle.
Jeez. So you definitely, the way he disappeared screams mafia, right?
Yeah.
All of a sudden he's just gone.
He's just gone. Yeah. It's just like, you're here, you're not here. Okay.
Yeah.
And I think that was a known and cooperative effort because I don't think that the union itself was, deeply involved in it, but I'm sure that the mafia said, if we take care of this problem or this situation, would you be okay with that? And they were like, it's not us. Don't get us involved. So,
and once the team, I feel like in a big way, the mob is responsible for the reputation of the unions. Mm-hmm. Like people soured on unions. Oh, these guys. Well, you've got organized crime raiding its retirement plans and just using it like it's their personal bank account. Jimmy Hoffa, I'm guessing based on what I've read, it's just, he just got in over his head. He couldn't control those guys. Like, right. Mm-hmm.
He allowed the monies to be taken out of the retirement funds.
Yeah.
And he used,
I'm sure he's getting a kickback, right?
Oh yes, yeah. Absolutely. And he allowed those monies to be used to build some of the casinos in Las Vegas. He put tons of money into that, and some of them were successful.
Okay.
So the payback on them was not there, and he needed to figure out how to get this all straightened out again. And, he had been living a life that, seldom touched by anybody else.
It's fascinating. All right, last one for you when it comes to murders. Who do you think? Do you think the mob had anything to do with Kennedy's assassination?
Oh, wow. There have been a couple different theories about that. I'm going to have to try to think of his name now. The man who played Meathead in All in the Family. I can't think of his name.
Oh, yeah, Rob Reiner. Yeah.
Rob Reiner. He did a podcast about this. And it was interesting, and he said it was kind of a joint effort of the mafia, CIA, FBI, and the military at secondary and third levels cooperating because of the suggested changes that Kennedy had in regards to backing off on military intrusions, changeover of the French Indochina War, which became the Vietnam War. And where Kennedy had actually been there back in the 1930s, 40s, and said, you're never going to win a war here. And when he was president, he said, we've got too many people there already. We're going to back this off. And the military.
But they were just doing recon, right?
Yeah.
I think they sent some people to kind of explore the situation. But he decided, at least in a book I wrote about Kennedy, was that he didn't want that.
Right. They were supposed to be military advisors.
They were
always told. And that never happened. They wanted to send more, and he said no, and that was part of the problem. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, it was the military that said, we need to nuke those guys. Well, it turns out that they had, the nuclear weapons in Cuba already. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was,
too many people get rich off of war. That's really interesting stuff, Bob. What are your favorite? Do you have a favorite mob movie or TV show that you've watched?
Well, I love the movies.
Yeah.
The Irishman was a little too long for me.
I agree.
It was a good movie, and I love seeing everybody, and I love seeing everybody cast in different roles where Joe Pesci was, the Godfather type.
Yeah.
I thought that was a nice come around. But and obviously The Godfather is great. A lot of people don't like The Godfather 2 or 3, but I enjoyed them. I thought they were all right.
Oh, I think some people say they like The Godfather 2 better than Godfather 1, and I'm not in that camp, but I agree. Godfather 3, I didn't like a lot. Have you seen a film called Miller's Crossing?
No.
Coen Brothers? Mm-hmm. It's about the Irish mob in Baltimore.
Hmm.
And it's told only a way, really, the Coen Brothers can tell that they have great characters. Albert Finney plays the mob boss, the Irish mob boss in Baltimore. And it's called the Danny Boy scene. If you just go home and YouTube the Danny Boy scene.
Okay.
It's one of the greatest scenes in movie history, how he gets out of this. He's just at home having a cigar, and he hears something that's off, and he fights off these intruders. It's so great. And it's one of my favorite mob films. Where are you on Goodfellas?
Well, I love Goodfellas.
Yeah.
If it comes on and we're at home and when we're cruising the remote going through, any mafia movie comes on, I stop. And it's like, are you really going to watch that again? You've only watched it 100 times. I'm sorry, dear. I really didn't say it that way.
You married me.
Yeah, we've been married 38. It'll be 39 years in September, but she always reminds me it is on a day-to-day basis.
what about, is Johnny Fontaine, who's supposed to Frank Sinatra. Mm-hmm. My understanding was it was the Chicago mob because they controlled Hollywood. It was Tony Accardo, mm-hmm. Accardo or Giancana, one of them that made the call to get Sinatra and not the New York mob. But I think mm-hmm. filmmakers who are primarily from New York or L.A. kind of switch that. And whatever, they can take liberties. It's a
Giancana and Frank Sinatra were very tight.
Yeah.
Whenever there was a problem and he needed to deal with something, he would contact Sam Giancana and Sam would help him with it.
Wow.
And Giancana was the one that went in and said, you know, this kid makes the movie. And
It
saved his career because he was floundering at the time.
Isn't that something?
So,
yeah. Boy, that's incredible. This has been fun, Bob. You got to come back and we just kind of scratched the surface here. And I also, next time you come back, I want to talk to you about urban legends. Okay. Can you tease us with about a 30-second urban legend quote that we can leave people with so that they're excited for you to come back to?
Well, Urban Legends is basically a podcast that talks about different things that you don't hear in the news every day.
Okay.
And it can be any number of things. I mean, I did 10 podcasts today. I recorded them all and just got them all. I put 6 on one and 4 on the other. And so I don't always remember everything that I've done, but it's... if you go to Urban Legends and Stranger Truths, if you Google that in, it'll come up right away. It'll pop right up.
All right. Urban Legends and Stranger Truths. That's another thing Bob has his hand in. Also, check out the Mob and Mafia News podcast.
And lest I not forget to say it, thank you so very much for having me here.
Oh, my pleasure. Any friend of Mike Desitel's is, a friend of Mike Desitel's. Okay. But it's been great having you. Thank you
so much. It's been awesome.
Bob. We'll
thank
do it again,
you.
I hope. Okay. Hey, the fun does not stop here. Linda Drews is coming up next to talk about her mysteries that she writes that primarily are set in Wisconsin. We'll talk to Linda next on Nightlight after more award-winning news updates from the Civic Media News team. This is Pete Schwabba and Nightlight on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Ain't no reason, don't be controlled. I fly so high, no ceiling when I'm in my zone. Cause I got that sunshine, if I forget, you got that good soul.
Broadcasting live from the Civic Media Studios in Green Bay, this is Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, your inside source on everything entertainment from Wisconsin to Hollywood. And now, a guy who appreciates a nice hot meal at a fair price, Pete Schwabba.
So, we just got a text from Bridget in the 818 who says, indecent proposal. That's another one of those. Like, Woody Harrelson has done so many films, you forget. And even reading this, Bridget could be lying, because I don't even remember him in that. I'm sure she's not, though. Bridget is a great regular texter who has, I love her texts. She says, I thought he was good, different than his Cheers character. 1993. Okay. Very nice, Bridget. Yes. And we could talk about... That could be a whole show, Conrad, talking about Woody Harrelson.
Definitely.
We're not going to do it tonight, though, because we got another phenomenal guest here on Nightlight. Joining me now in the studio is Green Bay resident and author Linda Drews. She has a new book out called The Maid and the Socialite. It's not new, really, though, is it? It's last year?
It came out in March of 2023.
Okay. But it's your most recent.
It's my most recent,
So before we get into that, I'm a writer myself. I'm not smart enough to write a book. I've written movies, but how... Tell us about you and your writing career. How did you get started as an author writing books?
It does sound a little weird. I was at, I went to La Crosse and I was the first computer science major graduate. And I also took some writing classes at the time and I really enjoyed writing, but I put that on the back burner because computer science was actually taking off. You know, that tells you how old I am, actually.
Come on, you're not that old.
But it was taking off, so I worked for 30 years at IBM. But during that time period is when my best running friend, her name was Pam Bulick, from Green Bay as well, she was actually died, and it was mysterious means by her husband in the end, first-degree murder trial. It was considered the most...
Wow.
Highly attended Green Bay's history because it was a three-teacher love triangle here in town. And because of that story, when I was working at IBM, I always knew I had to write it. So when I retired from IBM, the first day I could, at 30 years, I retired when I was 51, I started to write that story. And that's really became Run at Destruction, which came out. And just say that it did. Ann Rule, which was the best-selling true crime author, gave me her endorsement.
I saw that.
And then also I did get on Netflix and the ID channel with true crime segments that were based on my book.
Where can people find the true crime segment?
They on Netflix and IT channel.
What is it called? What is it? What's the title?
I'd have to.
So if they Google Netflix or go to Netflix and type in.
Yep. If you would look for Run at Destruction, okay. You'd find those. Right.
That's great.
And they are still out there. I just researched them the other day for somebody and I can't remember the
names
anymore.
Do you get a taste of that when they do that? They must pay you initially.
Yes, they give me a little bit.
All right.
Not real much.
I'm
you don't make
very
much at
nosy
this.
Here.
You know, you like to write and you like to do this kind of stuff. That's why you do it.
That's fascinating, though. You were 51 when you wrote your first book and it's this huge success. You must have, when that happened, were you like, why didn't I do this when I was 25? Or were you like, well, this is what started me and it was an ode to your friend, more or less?
That's basically what it was. It was really, you know, it was really. A good story to write at that time because it made me understand her death better.
Yeah.
So it was really a healing process. But after that, then I decided, boy, I really like to write. So it's been a great retirement job, I gotta say.
So did you work in computer science before you were writing?
Yeah. For 30 years, I worked at IBM, both computer science, and then I ended up with a global marketing job flying all around the world that kind of thing. So
I'm going to be honest with you, Linda. People that are incredibly successful at two totally different things really tick me off.
Oh.
It's very intimidating.
Yeah.
So, all right, this is fascinating because you gave a commencement speech at UW La Crosse in 2009, 2006?
Yeah, 2006,
okay.
I think it was, yeah.
And you told everybody to journal.
Right.
First of all, why is journaling important to you?
You know, at the time, and the way I journaled, it sounds weird, but I was a runner always, you know, like that first book is about our running group.
Yeah.
So the way I journaled is really you would write in your running log things about your day and what you felt and experienced and that kind of thing, because I ran for, you know, 40 years.
Wow.
So that's really where I did it. And it's really good to look back and see what you wrote. And sometimes it helps you with writing a story as well later.
Is it different than, like, over the 4th of July, a friend of mine posted on social media, those of you who are going to film the fireworks, don't waste your time. You will never watch that again.
Right.
And that's very true. But when it comes to a journal with written words, how often do you actually go back and read,
you know,
what you wrote?
You don't necessarily. I think it's when you want to remember something, you go back and capture that moment. Now, I write a lot more now because I'm always journaling when I would see something that's important or something I might use in another story. I'm always journaling that way. Because when you're just sitting at a coffee shop or something like that, you might write down what you're experiencing, seeing, and because you might use it in something as well.
So you told all these students, you gave the commencement speech at your alma mater, UW La Crosse in 2006. You told them all to journal, and then you say in your bio, that led to Run at Destruction, your first book. How did all those students journaling lead to this?
No, it was basically, I just said that if you do journal your life, then it gave me really the basis for writing the story myself. But I just, it was just one of the things that I told students to do because it's really an important thing in your life that you might want to look back on later on.
That is just crazy. So when the crime took place in the 80s?
Yes, it took place in the 80s. And, you know, like I say, it was just unbelievable because it was in this close-knit running community. We were really a wholesome group, I say. Most of us were high school sweethearts. We were married together and all that.
Oh, wow.
And so this was very unusual at the time when this happened.
Was it hard to confront that when you were writing the book, or was it cathartic? How did you feel writing the book? Was it hard to get through?
You know, I had to write it in both as myself, the way I felt, and I'm really a person in the story because it's a narrative nonfiction and I'm living the time at the time. And then I have to play two hats and then be also do all the investigative stuff that I did with all the interviews I did with, you know, police and jurors and Wow. All those, you know, the judge, everybody gave me, you know, interviews. So I had to write that two-sided. And then when you're doing this, so you have to live it the way you lived it. But near the end, then I have to go back and be really put on that other hat again of being more of a journalist and explaining truly without my emotion really what I believe happened. And that's why I thought in the end, her husband, who's the bad guy, got the right justice. So
where can people find this book?
Yeah,
now?
That's it's still on Amazon. Here, local in town, you know, still Bosses carries it, and so does Lion's Mouth. Nice. And actually, it's at Neville Museum.
Wow, yeah. That's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. What was that like? Did they approach you and say, we want to showcase your book?
Well, I've done talks there on that book. And my most recent one, I've given two large talks recently. You know, they sold out their auditorium for those talks on my current book.
Jeez, so. Good for you. Okay, so let's, my guest, by the way, is Linda Drews. She is an author and the author of books like Run at Destruction, which we were just talking about. Now we want to shift, and I want to ask you about your most recent book, The Maid and the Socialite, Behind the Scandals of the Minahan Trial. This was released in 2023. Give us a little background on that story, if you would.
Yes. What happened is that I had written this first book, and I really got so much support from the community in that book. It really was a book club book as well. So many, many book clubs read that first book and would have me at meetings and things like that. So it was really, I liked being part of the community with that. So I wrote two fiction books in between, which I did okay with those, but they just aren't the kind of book I like to write as well. I love to do research.
You like the investigative part of the
I
process.
I do. I really do. So when I was looking into writing a fourth book, I thought, what kind of story could take place in Green Bay? And some of my friends said, oh, you're not going to find anything. Nothing happened good in Green Bay. Only the Packers stuff, you know. So I decided, well, I thought about this. I lived, when we moved here, we ended up living in the Astor neighborhood on Jackson Street. And when we moved there, I didn't know it was going to become part of the historic district, but we had to do research on our homes. And I found out that one of the Minahans, which was attorney V.I. Minahan, had lived in my home. I remembered that from way back. So when I started to think about writing another book, I thought, well, maybe this Minahan family might be interesting, because I knew there had been the Minahan building, the Minahan Stadium, one of the science hall at St. Norbert was named for a Minahan. All that had gone on. So I thought, let me look if there's anybody who's written a book. There had been no books written. So I thought, all right, maybe that would be a good subject. So I started to do my research. Now I can use newspaper.com. Back in the researching my first one, that was not even available yet. So now you can do keyword searches, and I put in Minahan and Green Bay. Now this is from 1893 to 1945. So I put those search criteria in, and there's like 35,000 hits. They were quite prolific in getting reported on. I decided, how do I get that smaller? How can I ever go through that stuff to begin with? And I put in the word trial, and it was because of my first book.
Wow.
So when I put the trial in, all of a sudden these cases of these two women from very different walks of life popped up with three trials each. One was a maid, and one was a socialite that was married to Minahan. And this is Dr. John R. Minahan, and he was the top surgeon in Green Bay. He started St. Vincent Hospital. I mean, he was the first surgeon at the St. Vincent Hospital. And I found out that he was the bad guy, but he was the one in the family that he total terrible abuse of his maid throughout her, you know, her life and his wife. And there's a syphilis overriding theme in this. And
oh,
it's
my
really,
gosh.
Yes, it's really, I uncovered these stories. And instead of now writing the story about the Minahan family, I decided I had to give these two women a voice.
Wow.
To tell their stories of in this era that no women really got to tell, the average woman got to tell their stories.
How on earth, like, you talk about stumbling into a really cool situation. And this is because you bought a home that used to belong to one of the Minahans?
Correct, yeah. And it was attorney V.I. Minahan. He'd been the Press Gazette president and editor. And my kids always like to say when they lived in our house, the man who had lived there when the Packers were formed. It was in his office when they formed, when he was living in our house. So
did he ever receive justice in his life?
Yeah. So now the one that lived in our house did not. He still was one of the good brothers.
Right.
Okay. The one that is the bad person. No, he really never received justice. You know.
So it sounds like reading this book would be a little frustrating.
Well, I should say he received some justice.
He received justice in that you wrote the book posthumously.
Yes,
sadly,
but he did receive some justice from the second, because I've got three themes: wealth versus poverty, men's entitlement versus women's liberty, and false information versus scientific fact. And so at this time, the wealth versus poverty, the maid has, it's really hard for her. Mm. She's poor.
Right.
But Minahan's wife, who's the other victim here, she's still wealthy. So she gets some justice where the other one does not. Yeah.
That is incredible. Where can people find this?
Same places. It's on Amazon. It was just picked for one of their books of the month on Amazon about 2 months ago.
Okay.
So it's still doing very well. So.
And it's great. They offer, when we come back, Linda is going to talk about a walking tour for The Maid and the Socialite. And I'm going to ask her about her process and one more book, if we have time, that you had set in Door County, which I always find Door County to be a cool place for settings, especially mysteries. This is Pete Schwab and Nightlight. Great to have you with me on this Tuesday night here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Adjusting volumes here at Nightlight with Linda's headphones. We have a few more minutes here with author Linda Drews. She is a Green Bay-based writer. Pardon me. And she's written books like Run at Destruction and The Maid and the Socialite. The Maid and the Socialite, The Behind-the-Scenes Scandals of the Minahan Trial is the full title. So you can find those both on Amazon. You personally offer a walking tour of The Maid and the Socialite? That sounds really interesting.
You know, what happened is I am on the board for the Brown County Historical Society. And when I joined it, we talked about programs that we could do just for the society that could be new. And I said, well, you know, I've written this book, and it happens to take place right here in the historic district. And even one of the family members had lived in the historic Hazelwood home as well. So I decided that I brought this up as maybe this is a great idea to do a walking tour. And I have done now, I think, 30 of them. I'm the only one who leads them.
Good way to get your steps.
Yes, I do get my. I always walk 4 miles a day anyway. So, but it is nice. two hours long each. And I go by 20 of the homes and I tell the story that they've read as well. And I was adding it up, and like I've had like 750 people go through these, which is, and they've all read the book as well. And they always have these questions and thoughts and all that kind of thing with it. So it's really an enjoyable way of showing the book and telling Mary's and Molly's stories.
Do you have room for Conrad in one of your walking tours?
Yes, I would. Probably.
He loves to hoof it. He plays golf. Probably uses a cart, but you can use a cart in a walking tour, right? What brought you to Green Bay, Linda?
What happened is my husband got a job here. We both went to La Crosse, and I got a job at IBM in Rochester, Minnesota. And then he still was looking for a teaching job. He got the teaching job here in Green Bay, so I gave up my job at IBM in Rochester. They had one position here in Green Bay for IBM, and I got the position.
Oh,
so that's
nice.
How it ended up here.
Wow.
And I just worked for the same company my whole life. So.
That's kind of rare, right?
It's now, rare.
That's good for you, though.
Well, back in those days, it was gold, not quite as
you
rare.
You got the gold watch.
yeah, I did.
Do you think your books would make good movies? Like you said, there's a true crime thing.
You know what? Everybody keeps saying for The Maiden of Socialite, it really could make a good movie. But the problem is that when they make a movie, unless they think it's going to do extremely well, it's a period piece. And for period pieces, it's very hard to film it. It's a lot of scenery, different things, you know, to put it back into 1893 to 1945.
You need a pretty big budget for that.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So that's the problem, probably. It was made, though. I got audiobook offer, and so that was done. So this is Maiden of Socialite in audio and Kindle, you know.
Did you read it?
No, I didn't. Oh, okay. It's an actress that does it. Because many voices have to be given. I couldn't have done all those voices, I guess.
Not, yeah.
Yeah. There is a lot of men's voices in it and different people during trials and things. And they do it quite well. So.
Well, here's what we could do. Conrad could do your walking tour and he can provide the voice. Conrad's done some of our sketches we've done here. He played the who were you in the last sketch, Conrad? Sketch?
You were Chad?
Like a bro. Yeah. Chad. In the Hawk to a Girl. You don't need to write a book about that. What is your process like, Linda? Do you write every day? Do you wait for something to inspire you? How do you operate?
I do like to write probably every day. And I am doing research on another book right now. So I just was in Madison at the Historical Society there doing research. Then I like to gather as much research, but then you have to know when to stop researching because people, if you don't know how to stop, you never write. So
you eventually just have to put it to bed and start.
You do, yeah. And then I usually do work out what my themes are. And when I know my themes, then I can start whittling down what I'm going to include in a book or not because of my themes.
Do you have writers that have influenced you or that write the kind of books you write? Or did you kind of find this yourself, your own sort of, not necessarily genre, I guess it's crime, but who's influenced you?
Yeah, it's, you know, narrative nonfiction is what I like the best.
Okay.
So, you know, it was, you know, like Devil in the White City.
Great book.
You know, actually that book takes place actually in the same year. It starts the same year as my book
kidding.
Does too. So you can even picture my book and that happening at the same time.
Wow.
You know, one in Green Bay, one down in Chicago, because they really did happen at the same time.
That was so horrifying.
Yeah.
That was almost two books. Like, because how they built the White City for the World's Fair was enough for a book on its own. And then you got the worst serial killer, supposedly, in American history, killing people in Chicago.
Right.
Incredible.
Yeah, so
book.
Eric Larson. I mean, he's really good. And then, of course, I reread Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, because that's the first narrative nonfiction that was ever written. And mine is really called Historical True Crime. And that's what both of those are. I also, though, read, you know, I like books like Radium Girls and that were talk about women and how women fought the system, not necessarily always winning, but.
Stood up and.
Right. So that kind of book I like.
So what do you like to read? Are you a reader? Most writers are, but I'll tell you this, and I'm embarrassed to admit this. When I started writing like screenplays, my brain was so fried at the end of the day, I couldn't read a book. And I used to be a reader. I was an English major in college. Are you too tired to read books at the end of the day after you write, or do you still read?
I still read constantly.
Good for you.
And, you know, it's different when you're reading now, when you write, you always are reading, not always, you know, for the story. But you also like to see the way they did their craft. So it's a different approach when you read now than I did before, because I've always been an avid reader.
That's really cool. How cool was it to give the commencement speech at your alma mater? Oh, that must have been
a good day. That was pretty interesting, right? I know.
I mean, that had to be like a real thrill. Like I gave a speech to high schoolers when I was 26. I didn't even know what I was talking about at 26. I had nothing for them. You know, I would imagine you being out in the world and crushing it at IBM. That's got to be a thrill.
Yeah. No, it was quite interesting being able to stand up there. And especially it was your school. I'd done a couple of things with some computer science classes there. And I think they knew me. And then they realized that they found out that I was the first woman and the first graduate in computer science from La Crosse. So.
I can't thank you enough for your time. Thank you for coming in person. It's great to meet you, and I look forward to reading your work and maybe even taking a walking tour.
All right.
I think it'd be really fun.
Sounds
thank you
good.
Very much.
Thanks.
All right, that's All right. Linda Drews. Tomorrow night on Nightlight, Matt Gable will be here. He is the general manager of the Meyer Theater. We'll talk to Matt about A Ghost and what's upcoming there, and then comedian Jake Snell, who will be performing at Comedy on State on Thursday night and part of Madison Comedy Week in early August. Thank you all for your texts. Thank you to Bob Dennis, and thank you to Linda Drew. We'll see you tomorrow night. We'll be back with more Nightlight with Peach Wabba on the Civic Media Radio Network. Good night, Wisconsin. Take me to your best friend's house.